Riding home from school on the bus, Jose gave his friend Pedro a piece of candy. Jose kept giving Pedro all the brown ones, and eventually Pedro asked him. Jose told him they were coffee flavored, and Pedro asked, "Why does that matter?" Jose explained he was Mormon, and Mormons didn't drink. Pedro was still confused and said, "But this is just candy. It's not real coffee." Jose said he knew, but he still didn't want to eat it. Then Jose told Pedro more about Mormons and invited him to church.
I love coffee, I love tea, I love the Java Jive and it loves me. Coffee and tea and the Java and me. A cup.
Stories like this one from the friend have become one of the most potent identity markers of contemporary LDS Mormons. The word of wisdom has become perhaps the most obvious way that many Mormons, particularly LDS Mormons, both choose to define themselves as well as how outsiders can pick up on the unique character of Mormons. This year at Sunstone on our panel, we talked about Mormon identity, what it means. One of the things I mentioned was how word of wisdom has become this key part of self-image. During our panel, I shared a story about Billy Casper, who was a convert and also a very successful pro golfer. In a story about him in Time, the fact that he didn't smoke or drink was obviously brought up. It's, you know, de rigueur here. So where did this piece of Mormon identity come from, and how did it develop to become this identity marker? Today's discussion will be what we're going to call a forest view episode. Some topics don't really work very well if you split it up into a whole bunch of different parts, so we'll talk about the whole entire history today at once.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion, this isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
But what even is the word of wisdom? Some say it's a health guideline, some say it's a commandment, a revelation, who knows? In any case, it's muddied, sometimes inconsistent, and it's supposed to be a sort of, I don't know, health code for Mormons to live by, but even saying health code is controversial in some Mormon circles. It's really the things you can eat and can do and can't do with your body. But it's not as simple as it sounds. The beginning of the 19th century was such a vibrant time in American religion. Various new groups were sprouting up, and the boundaries of theology were really being explored. So, as part of this expansion, ideas at the intersection of religion and health were very much a part of the discussion. In tandem with various secular organizations, the temperance movement was spreading throughout the nation. Alcohol would be the primary target of the movement, as it would be for basically the next century. But other items too, such as tobacco, coffee, and tea, were occasionally sort of lumped in together. Various local chapters of the temperance movement were organized, including one, dun-dun-dun, in Kirtland in 1830.
It doesn't appear that the early Mormons in Kirtland were very active in the society, but they probably had relatives they were, and they were certainly aware of the national temperance movement, both because of things they were hearing in their local papers, you know, things that were happening in the area, but also bigger things. The movement started to heat up in February 1833. On the first of the month, the local society there in Kirtland succeeded in shutting down the distillery there, but also the nearby one in Mentor. Then, this was really fun, has been the American Temperance Society, so the national group, the previous fall, had designated February 26th of 1833 as a day when, quote, meetings of temperance societies and friends of temperance be holden simultaneously in all the cities, towns, and villages throughout the United States. So, if the nation would come together and fight demon rum and Mike's hard lemonade, but not Porter's fire cinnamon whiskey, we need that to wash people in the Kirtland Temple, then, quote, cholera, that scourge of the nations, which has spread sackcloth round the globe and threatened to cover our land with mourning, would be nearly, if not altogether, unknown. The deep fountains of human sorrow would be dried up, and ever-growing light, purity, and joy, under the means of divine appointment, with all who obey the divine will, would universally prevail. Now, who doesn't want to get on board with this?
So, we can't really say what the response to the call for meetings on the 26th in Kirtland was, but we do know that Joseph Smith received a revelation the next day. Sadly, there really aren't any contemporary references to what went on this day, but interestingly, later accounts of the revelation and its genesis focus on tobacco. This is where we get another Brigham Young story about Emma. Those are my favorite. Here's what we have. A month before the Word of Wisdom revelation, the School of Prophets was started in Kirtland. The dudes, two dozen of them, would pack into a room and, according to Brigham, inevitably stick a chaw of tobacco in and start the spitting. I mean, as if this idea of a bunch of men sitting back and planning the kingdom of God weren't interesting enough, picture them chewing tobacco while they did it. It fell to Emma to clean it up, such a hefty responsibility in Zion, and she got sick of this very quickly. So she sort of put a bug in Joseph's ear about it, and he apparently asked God, and revelation was a result. That's very convenient, I think. I wish that I could have a revelation on the end of my honey-do list, too. Honestly, out of all the later stories about Emma, this one actually seems kind of plausible. Doesn't take too much imagination to see that scrubbing the holy dude's spit-caked floor would sort of piss you off. Kind of pisses me off thinking about it. Reminiscing even later than the Brigham Young story, David Whitmer made it more cut and dried. He wrote that Emma Smith said, quote, "It would be a good thing if a revelation could be had declaring the use of tobacco a sin and commanding its suppression." The matter was taken up and joked about. One of the brethren suggested that the revelation should also provide for a total abstinence from tea and coffee drinking, intending this as a counter dig at the sisters. Sure enough, the subject was afterward taken up in dead earnest, and the Word of Wisdom was a result. Stories like this certainly could have been part of the equation, but larger trends in temperance and what was going on in the medical circles absolutely has to be considered. But come on, is it really as petty as a bunch of dudes laughing that the women want to take away their cigarettes, so they're going to take away their tea? Is that how this works?
Like pretty much all of Joseph Smith's revelations, sadly, we don't have the original dictated version. The earliest manuscript source that we do have seems to be a text that Sidney Gilbert copied into his notebook, probably a few months after the revelation. Interestingly, this version indicates that the revelation is for the, quote, benefit of the saints in these last days. When it is copied into the Revelation book back in there in Kirtland, the text then said it was for the, quote, benefit of the council of high priests assembled in Kirtland and the church, and also the saints in Zion, i.e. Missouri. And this is how the text then would appear in the later editions of the Doctrine and Covenants. The introduction to the Revelation has a few points that are very much integral to the rest of our discussion today. The Revelation is sent, quote, not by commandment or constraint, and, quote, given for a principle with promise, adapted to the capacity of the weak and the weakest of all saints. These two phrases are kind of curious, and you can even think of them as being at odds with one another. The elements of this Revelation aren't mandatory, but at the same time, they're also adapted so even the weakest Mormon should be able to do it.
So, speaking of things that Mormons should be able to do, any Mormon knows that we have a few little games that we can't help doing. I don't care if you're Mormon, ex-Mormon. One of them, of course, is, oh, you're so-and-so? Hey, do you know so-and-so? Because you have the same last name. Oh, you're from Kusharim? Do you know Lepriel Christensen? Wait, you're a Nielsen? You're a Tom Nielsen from the Tom Nielsen family? I bet you're from Tokerville. Another game that we really like to play is, so what do we think the Word of Wisdom actually means? Because the revelation was given in a particular time and place, with a particular context, reading it nearly 200 years later creates some issues. For example, when I went down into a fundamentalist Mormon community in Centennial Park, they had a liquor store, and I was so confused about that. So I went inside the liquor store, and they were selling, you know, all kinds of alcohol. And then there were pictures of Ty Detmer and BYU memorabilia all over the wall. And that was such an interesting experience for me. Okay, so let's sort of wander through the ingredients of the Word of Wisdom and work through some things and see if we can understand and sort of untangle this very important and very inconsistent health code. So we have, inasmuch as any man drinketh wine or strong drink among you, behold, it is not good, neither meat in the sight of your father, only in assembling yourselves in your sacraments before him, and behold, this should be wine of your own make. Just remember that word. Wine of your own make, because I think this comes in handy later. Given the fervor of the temperance movement in the country at the time, it's not really surprising that the first thing mentioned in this revelation is alcohol. The temperance movement had something going for it that modern folks probably don't realize. The 19th century was crunk. People were drunk all the time. Estimates are that per capita consumption at the time of the Word of Wisdom was probably 9.5 gallons of spirits per person a year. And when we say spirits, we're not talking the holy kind. We're talking alcohol and the harder stuff. And 27 gallons of beer a year. I mean, I drink a lot of Diet Coke, probably triple that. But that's a lot. That's a lot of alcohol. That's a good, decent amount. Answering why leads to another point that us moderns also don't really appreciate. Actually, two related points. Water was often super gross and bad for you. Maybe not like visibly gross, though sometimes reading about Mormon battalion dudes straining out wigglers from their water meets the guidelines for gross, in my opinion. But we're talking like microscopically gross. And what caused disease was definitely not understood at that point. Remember earlier how the temperance leaders thought that their movement could end cholera? So this sounds weird, but it was a very logical chain of thought behind it. Drinking was bad. Bad behavior resulted in divine punishment. That came in the form of disease. So God punished you for bad behavior with floods and grasshoppers and disease, etc. Actually, the fermented cider that they could have been drinking was much more likely to ward off cholera than their temperance zeal. But this is how they understood things at the time.
Now, wine was a different matter. It was okay for sacramental use thanks to an earlier August 1830 revelation, which is now DNC 27. The next portion of the Word of Wisdom revelation indicated that, quote, strong drinks are not for the belly, but for the washing of your bodies. Different category of alcohol now. So this is the whiskey area. This is the stuff with the higher alcohol content. Now, remember the distinction between strong drinks and the lighter stuff, because that will be a point that'll come up again and again. Now, next in the revelation is probably the most straightforward part of it. Quote, tobacco is not for man, but is for bruises and all sick cattle to be used with judgment and skill. Seems like there wouldn't be much wondering about this one, at least until vaping comes on the scene. Thanks, Newsroom, for straightening us out on that one. Quick tangent on the use of tobacco and treating animals. I work at Benchmark Books, and we're trying to publish a new edition of the Wilford Woodruff Journals. So Tim Corey and I are working on an index for it, and part of this is we're just like, oh man, check out this crazy thing I just found in there. So Wilford Woodruff, rather than following the instructions here on using tobacco to fix his horse, occasionally used, let's say, unconventional methods. For example, when his horse needed some TLC, Woodruff, quote, physicked him with human dung, then gave him alcohol and cayenne to sweat him. I also set his feet in hot water as hot as he could bear it. I covered him with blankets and tried to steam him with hot rocks, but did not get him to sweat much. Tim and I joke that Wilford's horses probably started running the other way when they saw Wilford coming with his doctor kit.
Shoot me the pot, now pour me a shot. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup.
Hot drinks are not for the body or belly. Okay, so welcome to the main event, folks. Mormons have probably said more words and spilled more ink on this phrase than anything else combined. Hot drinks are not for the body or belly. The drinks that they're talking about aren't specified, and the reason why isn't spelled out, so it's going to cause confusion, consternation, sacrifice, and resentment. For years and years to come, a knowledge gap waiting to be filled. Any good missionary worth his salt at some point had a discussion about tannins and tannic acid being the cause. And let's be honest, so did I. I didn't even know what tannins were, but I knew how to use it in a sentence. We probably have John and Leah Widstow to thank for this. Their book, Word of Wisdom, A Modern Interpretation, which is still in print, by the way, has been very influential over the years. So family stories indicate that Leah was actually the real hardliner on the topic. Their grandchildren tell how when Grandpa was driving, the car would often magically turn into the parking lot of the ice cream parlor, and Grandpa would protest that he had nothing to do with it. At any rate, Widstow was both an apostle and a PhD, so don't mess with him. Double the power. Once Coca-Cola, aka Satan's Juice, my favorite, powered by this podcast is powered by that, came on the scene, caffeine became sort of a topic of interest. So, of course, Coca-Cola wasn't around when Joseph Smith wrote the Word of Wisdom, but people liked it too much, like me, and we can't have people enjoying things too much. So over the next few decades, Mormons, minding this sort of knowledge gap, deduced that coffee and tea both have caffeine. Ta-da! Caffeine is the common element that makes them bad. Caffeine is the evil thing. Well then, delicious soda beverages such as Coke or Diet Coke with caffeine in them must also fall under that umbrella, no matter if they are cold as can be. So caffeine, cold or hot, not really good, but actually it's worse hot. We can now drink Diet Coke on campuses, church campuses, and church buildings. You cannot drink coffee.
It's a little surprising that the prophetic vision of the Word of Wisdom not being strong enough to foresee the advent of Jolt Cola hasn't been responsible for more faith crises, but I digress. Of all of our million discussions on tannins and tannic acid and caffeine, I think we've ignored a very simple solution. The Revelation mentions simply hot drinks. Maybe what they are and what's in them really isn't the point. So remember, 1833 is definitely the pre-scientific era. Most people conceived of the healthy body as being one in kind of a stable, temperate state, just kind of right there in the middle. And they weren't wrong. We even have a fancy 25-cent word, homeostasis, for it. But it's a lot more complex than they knew at that time. The thought was that these hot drinks would throw the body out of this centered state and would then cause disease. And many cultures still hold this line of thinking. Again, ask a few returned missionaries and you'll guaranteed get some stories about being refused ice in your drink because it would absolutely make you sick because, you know, it's hot outside, you know. Doesn't matter if it's 103 and 84% humidity outside, Elder. You get zero ice, sir. The moral of the story, however, is definitely clear. It's caffeine's the real culprit, and anyone who drinks it, like, you know, Diet Coke, for example, these people lack souls and will live with Hitler and John C. Bennett, worlds without end.
Just a wine, oh, love my wine. Make it matter, chef, is ever doggone time.
So the no-nos of the Word of Wisdom would end here, and here's where the yes-yeses begin. If you have talked about the Word of Wisdom more than 5 minutes with any Mormon, you know that the yeses receive less than 1% of the attention, right? Nobody pays attention to the things that you can do and you can drink. We want to talk about the things you can't do. It's our favorite thing. So let's go on a little side journey here. From the beginning, Mormons understood the Word of Wisdom as governing health. Even today, the Word of Wisdom is defined as the Mormon Code of Health, like I just talked about earlier, for non-Mormons. And at the time, this is exactly how it was presented to people. The elements of the Word of Wisdom were very much in line with how many people saw things. That was the same until 1833. Because the problem comes with translating a text encased in an 1833 context to 2019. Scientific understanding of the world has moved well beyond where it was in Kirtland nearly 200 years ago, and continuing to see it strictly as a health code rather than simply an identity marker results in some square peg and round hole moments. I mean, it makes sense that it was something to set people apart. These are the identity markers that Mormons are really good at. But then we have to sort of deify them and make a divine sense to it, and it doesn't always translate. What about the health benefits of alcohol, coffee, and tea? Because there are health benefits. I know that's shocking to Mormons to hear since we think it's literal poison. But Brigham Young didn't even think that extreme. Where does caffeine fit into the Word of Wisdom? Is it even part of the discussion? Well, apparently we think it is now, even though it's not mentioned. Should we continue to debate it fiercely? And here's the thing. The church, the LDS church, just came out with a new code. So some would argue it's just continuing revelation. Should we continue to debate it fiercely? Let's hope so on the last one, because a very interesting parallel is to look at how Judaism has interpreted kashrut, the laws governing what is kosher and what isn't. What does it mean in a modern world? Is it really intended to make you healthier? Or are the benefits less tangible? Is it just about sacrifice? An Orthodox Jewish man in the 1950s did an experiment where he provided extracts from ritually unclean and clean meats to plant seeds and found that, of course, only the ritually clean meats promoted growth. John and Lee Widstow would approve of this sort of scientific approach here. But how did we get from the revealed health code in 1833 to a potent identity marker of LDS Mormonism in 2019? Like, I can't even stress this enough. In my family, the culture of my family in interpreting this was alcohol was basically worse than murder. I mean, people that drink were the lowest of the low. And still today, you know, my family won't even go anywhere near it. They don't want it in the house. They think it's dangerous to have in the house. So, I mean, that's how potent it was for us. So are there any developments from 1833 till now that would be fun to talk about? You know us enough to know the answer is, of course, there are.
Hey, Mr. Bartender, please don't be so slow. I got time for one more round and a six-pack to go.
By now, you've heard me on previous episodes, so you know that I am a bit of a revisionist historian, that I really enjoy challenging traditional narratives. But sometimes we historians take revisionism a little too far. And one of the topics that I think we get a little carried away on is the topic of the Word of Wisdom. So we revisionist historians love to talk about how nobody in the 19th century considered the Word of Wisdom a commandment, and that until the 20th century, the Word of Wisdom was a set of suggestions or a principle with a promise, and that's all. And that's partly true, okay? The Word of Wisdom had its ups and downs, and there was lots of non-observance in the 19th century. I don't want to downplay that. But there were also always some people who took the Word of Wisdom as a commandment, and there were always some moments in the 19th century when mandatory observance of the Word of Wisdom became church policy. So the 20th century saw the final triumph of this view of the Word of Wisdom as a commandment, but its earliest triumph dates all the way back to Kirtland in the 1830s, shortly after the Word of Wisdom was received. Now, the text of the Word of Wisdom is itself somewhat ambiguous as to whether it's a commandment or not. Revisionist historian types love to quote the beginning of the Word of Wisdom, where it quite explicitly says, "It's given not by commandment or constraint, but by revelation and the word of wisdom." In other words, this is not a commandment. It's just a recipe for a wise life. Period, case closed, that should resolve the issue, right? But no, because the Word of Wisdom ends by saying that those who forget to keep and do these sayings, walking in obedience to the commandments, will forfeit their spiritual blessings and protection from the destroying angel. In other words, it starts by saying, this isn't a commandment, NBD, and ends by saying, actually, this is a commandment, and if you don't follow it, then not only will you forfeit your blessings, but an angel will destroy you, totally a big deal. So, ambiguity within the text itself. And soon after the Word of Wisdom was given in February 1833, some members were already treating it as a commandment. In May 1833, a couple named Brown visit Joseph and Emma Smith, and Emma offers them tea or coffee, and the couple shortly apostatized because they had seen the prophet's own family wasn't observing the Word of Wisdom. That's how seriously they took the Word of Wisdom. In August of that year, Joseph delivered a revelation in which the Lord says, "I am not pleased with the saints at Kirtland because they haven't observed the words of wisdom I gave them." And this seems to be a reference to the Word of Wisdom, which sometimes in the 1830s was referred to as the Words of Wisdom. Early the next year, things got real. January 1834, Apostles Orson Pratt and Lyman E. Johnson are presiding over a conference in Springfield, Pennsylvania. And Elder Leonard Rich passes the sacrament at this conference. And some of the members who were present refused to take the sacrament from Rich, because they knew that he wasn't observing the Word of Wisdom. They had observed him probably drinking. And that caused an argument between the two apostles, Lyman Johnson and Orson Pratt. So Lyman Johnson defended these members and said they were right to refuse the sacrament, that Rich was in transgression. And Orson Pratt was vehemently on the other side, saying that until an elder's license is officially revoked by the church, the members are obligated to accept the sacrament from him. And so they go back to Kirtland the following month in February 1834, and they take this issue, this disagreement they've had before the Kirtland High Council. And on February 12th, the High Council officially brings charges against Rich for transgressing the Word of Wisdom. He repents and they forgive him, but this sort of sets a precedent that you can be charged and punished by the church for not observing the Word of Wisdom. And the following week, the High Council met again and debated the issue that Pratt and Johnson had disagreed on, whether those members were right to refuse the sacrament from Rich. And Joseph decides to have six members of the High Council speak on this matter. He kind of sounds them out, sees where they're at, listens to what they have to say. And then he delivers a decision which is doesn't really resolve the issue that Pratt and Johnson were concerned about, but it does officially declare for the first time that no official member in this church is worthy to hold an office in the church if he breaks the Word of Wisdom. So the council confirmed the decision by a vote, and this was the very first time that mandatory Word of Wisdom observance became something resembling official church policy. This was in February 1834. In August 1834, W.W. Phelps, who was a counselor in the First Presidency, wrote an epistle to the Church in Missouri. And this epistle told them that if they wanted to escape the destruction of the end times, they had to observe the Word of Wisdom. He alludes to that last line in the Word of Wisdom that says, basically, this is a commandment and you have to observe it if you want to escape the destroying angel. So the church is emphasizing at this point in Mormon history that last line that makes the Word of Wisdom a commandment rather than that first line that makes it a suggestion. In April 1835, there's another church disciplinary hearing, this time in New York, for Elder Chester Heath, who was charged with breach of covenant and not observing the Word of Wisdom. In May of 1835, W.W. Phelps wrote to his wife about the situation at Kirtland, and he said, "You are not aware how much sameness there is among the saints. They keep the words of wisdom in Kirtland. They drink cold water. They don't even mention tea and coffee." So that tells you how strongly the church at Kirtland was adhering to the Word of Wisdom at this time, to the point where they weren't even talking about tea and coffee, and they apparently drank cold water. And August of that year, Alman Babbitt was censured by the Kirtland High Council for breaking the Word of Wisdom, just like Leonard Rich had been. So this disciplinary proceedings for non-observance of the Word of Wisdom were becoming more common. And the policy of mandatory Word of Wisdom observance became even more official toward the end of 1836. In November, the Messenger and Advocate, which was the church's newspaper at the time, reprinted the High Council decision from 2 years earlier, making Word of Wisdom observance mandatory in order to hold church office. And then the following month in December, Sidney Rigdon, who was a counselor in the First Presidency, preached on the subject of the Word of Wisdom at a church conference and sort of drove this point home. And according to the Journal of Wilford Woodruff, Rigdon at this conference called for a vote of the entire membership to discountenance entirely the use of all liquors from the church in sickness and in health, except wine at the sacrament for external washing. The vote was carried unanimously. Now, this is kind of interesting because not only is the church voting to discountenance all consumption of liquor, but it's actually voting to discountenance all consumption of liquor in sickness and in health. A lot of people regarded alcohol to have medical properties, to be medicinal, and so they're rejecting it even as a medicine. So this is pretty strong stuff. In effect, Rigdon got the whole church membership to make a covenant not to drink alcohol. And so if there was any sense in which the Word of Wisdom previously had been just a guideline, now it was effectively a commandment for everyone who had held their hand up in order to make this covenant. Now, the Word of Wisdom now starts to crop up in patriarchal blessings. These are sort of personalized revelations. Every member receives one from a church patriarch. And the revelation makes them various promises about what is going to happen in their lives, promises them various kinds of blessings. And in 1836 and 1837, these blessings start to make all of the promises in the patriarchal blessing conditional on observance of the Word of Wisdom. They say essentially, if you want these promises to come true, you have to keep the Word of Wisdom. So really driving home that idea from the Word of Wisdom that your blessings are conditional, that if you don't keep the Word of Wisdom, you forfeit your blessings. In May 1837, the Messenger and Advocate published another editorial that made it clear that the Word of Wisdom wasn't just for church leaders. It was a commandment for people of high stations or low ones, and anyone who disobeyed the Word of Wisdom, no matter their station in the church, was mocking God. We get another covenant to keep the Word of Wisdom in the Kirtland Elders Quorum in October 1837. And a year later, Elder Joshua Bosley showed up to the Elders Quorum intoxicated, and the Quorum disfellowshipped him because he had broken his covenant. Another example of how seriously this was taken. The High Council ruled in 1837 or 1838 that you had to observe the Word of Wisdom to be a missionary or to get permission to move to Zion in Missouri. And missionary Jonathan Dunham illustrates how seriously he took this in a letter to his wife. He wrote home to his wife to remind her to keep the Word of Wisdom's requirements. He described them as requirements, not suggestions. So lots of evidence during this period of just how seriously the Word of Wisdom was taken. Another example, a big example in 1837 is when dissent broke out in Kirtland over Joseph Smith's illegal banking enterprise, and a bunch of high-ranking church leaders started questioning Joseph Smith, including W.W. Phelps, Oliver Cowdery, John Whitmer, David Whitmer, Lyman E. Johnson, so witnesses of the Book of Mormon, counselors in the First Presidency, apostles in the church, very high-ranking figures here who had turned against Joseph Smith. And at the excommunication hearings for these men, alleged non-observance of the Word of Wisdom was one of the pretenses that was used to push them out of the church. The conflict with dissenters in Kirtland got hot enough that Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon fled town, and they left the Quorum of the 70 in charge of bringing the rest of the Mormons along to Missouri a few months later. And so the 70, they stay behind, and they organize a emigration party called Kirtland Camp. And they write up this constitution for the camp that requires every member of the camp to observe the Word of Wisdom. And they had all the members of the camp covenant to observe the Word of Wisdom. So really throughout this whole Kirtland period, from the moment that the Word of Wisdom is delivered in 1833, right up to the time that the saints leave en masse for Missouri, the Word of Wisdom was taken very seriously and effectively treated as a commandment. So what changed? Well, for one thing, Missouri was just a different environment than Ohio. I mean, Kirtland had been pretty bougie. It had had a strong temperance movement, lots of teetotalers there, whereas Missouri was the rough and tumble frontier. The norms there were just different. People were just concerned about surviving, about getting by. They weren't that concerned about sort of these issues of middle-class respectability that had concerned people in Ohio. But more importantly, the leadership structure of the church changed. So in Kirtland, the church hierarchy had been fairly democratic. Joseph was the unquestioned head of the church, but he gave other leaders a lot of free rein to kind of do what they want. And after this big split between him and several of the apostles and Book of Mormon witnesses, he realized that he had given other people too much power to challenge him. And so from then on, he really rules the church with much more of an iron fist, does things his way, and doesn't take much guff from other people. And it's important to realize that all this insistence on the Word of Wisdom in Kirtland was on other people's initiative, not on Joseph Smith's. He was never really that into the Word of Wisdom thing. Even receiving the revelation in the first place was by request of Emma, right? Joseph went along with all of this business all along. He appeased the temperance advocates when they, raised issues, like with Leonard Rich passing the sacrament, even though he was not observing the Word of Wisdom. He goes along with the recommendations of the church leaders at that council meeting and makes it mandatory for church leaders to observe the Word of Wisdom. But it's kind of an open secret in Kirtland that he was not himself observing the Word of Wisdom. When Almon Babbitt was disciplined in 1835 for not obeying the Word of Wisdom, his defense at his church trial was that Joseph Smith didn't observe it either. And the High Council kind of admits, yeah, that's true, but you still need to follow the Word of Wisdom anyway. You should take care of yourself rather than worrying about other people. So Joseph Smith never really gets called out on this, but everybody knows that he's not observing the Word of Wisdom, even though the church as a whole has covenanted to keep it. And when the 70s organized Kirtland Camp in 1838 to go from Kirtland to Missouri, they made a big deal of the word of wisdom in the camp constitution, but Joseph Smith's brother Hiram, who had stayed behind in Kirtland, sort of takes the 70s aside and he says, look, guys, all this word of wisdom business is fine, but just don't make too big a deal of it. And the 70s didn't take his advice, but that was his position on it. So the Smith family, in general, apart from Emma, doesn't seem to be that big on this word of wisdom thing. It seems to be something that was pushed by other people that Joseph and his brothers just went along with, went along to get along. So when Joseph tightened his control over the church in Missouri and Illinois, he started to shut down the temperance people. And we see this in a sermon that he gave in November 1841. Another elder had preached for 2 hours, probably about the word of wisdom. And Joseph Smith gets up after this guy. This sermon was at the Nauvoo Temple lot. And he said, look, what many people call sin, I don't think is sin. And he specifically uses the example of Noah getting drunk in the Bible and Noah's son Ham laughing at him. And he says, look, in this story, Noah is the drunkard. Ham is the temperance advocate. But whose side does God take? He takes Noah's side, not Ham's. Ham and all his descendants get cursed. So God is on the side of the guy who got drunk, and he wasn't hurting anybody. He wasn't doing anybody any harm. And so this was not a sin. The sin was for Ham to accuse him. And so after this sermon, the high priest quorum and the quorum of the 12 get together. They have a meeting about this. And after listening to Joseph's remarks about this, they agree that a forced abstinence was not making us free, but rather had placed the church under bondage with a yoke upon our necks. So they reject the principle of forced abstinence. They reject the idea that the word of wisdom is a commandment. And they embrace a much more moderate interpretation of the word of wisdom, that it is simply that. It is a word of wisdom, not a commandment. And just like that, the word of wisdom officially stopped being a commandment, at least for the time being.
Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old.
Not surprisingly, a revelation that wasn't a commandment resulted in some confusion. So later accounts talk about these School of the Prophets dudes giving up their tobacco immediately. Might not surprise you that this is definitely not the case. Cold turkey is only good for post-Thanksgiving sandwiches and the plastic Ono band. That's it. There are some spotty accounts of implementing the word of wisdom no-nos, but they're definitely not consistent. My favorite is in Missouri, David and John Whitmer admit they drank tea and coffee, but quote, they did not consider them to come under the head of hot drinks. What are they then, Whitmers? And as for the strong drinks, it seems like it really had to be some excessive drinking to get you in trouble during this period. So at the same time, we have some official proclamations, like an 1834 statement from the Kirtland High Council, and then later reprinted in the church periodical, The Messenger and Advocate, that no official member could hold office if they didn't keep the word of wisdom. Very interesting. A couple other fun things from the 1830s. Heber C. Kimball later recorded that during the first British mission, so starting in 1837, the word of wisdom, quote, was almost universally attended to by the brethren. And this is odd, because the second British mission, just a few years later, is chock full of accounts of them popping in for tea with the members, wine, port, brandy. Actually, they did use it for washing sometimes, but not usually, and so on.
And just so you know, I covered a whole two-part series on the sort of inconsistencies in the Word of Wisdom, A Year of Polygamy. So if you want to listen to that episode, those two episodes, we talk more about that here. But back to the good old United States. When the Kirtland camp is preparing to move to Missouri, Hiram Smith instructs them, quote, not to be too particular in regards to the word of wisdom. That's interesting coming from the prophet's brother, right? Now, there are a few cases of people being disciplined for word of wisdom violations during this period, but they're minor things. You know, maybe they would get fined for public drunkenness, or maybe, you know, they were drinking too much and they beat their wife, something like that. But it seems likely that these might have been pretty flagrant episodes. You know, you can also hear accounts of William Clayton drinking pitchers of wine at every house he's going to, and he's making a lot of visits. So that's when home teaching was fun, you guys. Because in Nauvoo, there were distilleries and breweries, an example of Joseph Smith drinking and providing alcohol. Joseph Smith knew how to brew. I don't know how else to say it. The wine of your own make is important. I mean, even in Bryce Blinkenagel's entheogenic theory of religion, the idea is that maybe Joseph Smith spiked his own sacramental wine because that's how he was able to get people to ingest mushrooms. Who knows? But these guys weren't teetotalers. They definitely weren't teetotalers. They definitely weren't pure in the way that we live it today. The trek west to Utah continued the pattern of more or less lax interpretation of the revelation. In fact, it was quite common to, for when there was a wedding, and there were a lot of weddings in Utah, to provide the bride's family would provide alcohol for the wedding party. People were instructed to bring coffee, tea, and alcohol in the pages of the Nauvoo Neighbor when they came across the plains. So it was used a lot. And again, if you, Year of Polygamy goes into great specific detail, thanks to Claire Barris, about this.
And an element of this that we have to remember is that Joseph Smith, good brewer, he enjoyed having a good time. I mean, he just enjoyed life for the most part. And a lot of the accounts of them drinking alcohol is, you know, it's not to get drunk or whatever. It's just to enjoy themselves. So at weddings, at different things, their hearts were made glad is the phrase they often use, which I think is pretty awesome. But so once they get settled here in Utah, every so often, in kind of waves, the Word of Wisdom will get some attention. For example, in December 1850, Brigham Young and company meet in his upper room and decide, quote, "It was considered best to renew the Word of Wisdom." Again, if you have something that's not a commandment to begin with, it's always kind of nebulous how you implement it. Then, the following year is the big event. At the Fall General Conference, Patriarch John Smith spoke on the Word of Wisdom, and then W.W. Phelps moved the saints, quote, "Lay off the use of tea, coffee, tobacco, snuff." Brigham Young then got up and spoke and, quote, "put the motion." Don't you love how they're using Robert's rules of order here? And the deal is that the sisters first and then the boys under 90, quote, "covenant to leave off the use of tobacco, whiskey, and all things mentioned in the Word of Wisdom." Then, after the conference, the First Presidency sends out this general epistle and noted that they had, quote, "voted to observe the Word of Wisdom, and particularly to dispense with the use of tea, coffee, snuff, and tobacco, and in this thing, as well as many others, what is good for the saints in the mountains is good for the saints in other places." But notice, in the general epistle, they don't mention alcohol. And when Wilford Woodruff summarizes all of this in his journal, he also leaves it out, which is kind of curious. However, the conclusion that the Word of Wisdom became a commandment at this conference in 1851 will become very pervasive over the next century. Too bad it wasn't true.
Guess what? It wasn't that cut and dried. Surprise, surprise. Even Brother Brigham had a difficult time. Fun side note, Brigham and tobacco were partially responsible for bringing down Leonard Arrington in the Camelot years of the 1970s. The first book to come out of the history division under Arrington was Letters of Brigham Young to His Sons, edited by Dean Jesse. And in the book, Brigham writes to his son Brigham Young Jr., who was then on a mission, and he suggests that Jr. stop using tobacco and notes that he, Sr., had quit about 2 years earlier. So Boyd K. Packer read this in the book and had a passive-aggressive meltdown. You know what would chill him out? Is a little bit of weed. His four-page letter to the First Presidency was the first step in dismantling the history division. This was it. This was the thing that started all of it. A perfectly understandable reaction to, you know, actual history. Right now we're going to hear from my good friend Claire Barris, an independent historian and researcher who has done so much work on a timeline of the Word of Wisdom.
I recently ran across this observation by the former church historian, Leonard Arrington, who has been some fun discussion about him, his recently published journals, and a lot of people are combing through those and finding interesting stuff. This observation illustrates how observation of the Word of Wisdom had become really important in LDS culture by the 1970s. Arrington had spent part of an evening visiting with a couple who took in young, unwed LDS women who had gotten pregnant. They reported that, quote, "the daughter of a stake president who came into their home saw a carton of empty Coke bottles on the floor." Quote, "You certainly don't drink Coke, do you?" Close quote. There's one anecdote. And then in the same diary entry about this discussion, quote, another girl, a daughter of a bishop only 15 years old who was pregnant, stayed with them. The Christensen asked her which she thought was worse, to smoke or commit adultery. She thought and thought and was very serious and thought and thought and finally said she thought it was worse to smoke. Stories about Orrin Porter Rockwell are always fun, and Orrin really liked to drink. In Nauvoo, in 1843, Joseph Smith's diary mentions the newly installed Nauvoo Mansion House with a bar. According to Joseph Smith's son, it was a fully stocked bar. And guess who the bartender was? It was none other than Orrin Porter Rockwell. As is apparent, the word of wisdom was very loosely interpreted in the 19th century, even by Joseph Smith. His diary indicates that he, quote, rode out with Dr. Willard Richards and Orrin Porter Rockwell, and they went out to pay some bills. After they had exchanged $100 in gold for some cash, they apparently decided to relax, and his Joseph Smith's diary notes that they, quote, drank a glass of beer at Mosier's. Now, this was Frederick Mosier, who had a grog shop, as it was called, which, by the way, Joseph had condemned in a sermon earlier on August 12th, 1843. Later, when the manuscript History of Joseph Smith was published in the multi-volume History of the Church, this sentence about them stopping in to get a glass of beer was not included in the book. Nearly 2 years after the death of Joseph Smith, when the Nauvoo Temple was being dedicated in April 1846, the minutes proceed in pretty typical fashion, recording Brigham Young's remarks to the audience. Then, apparently, the meeting was interrupted, and the scribe's notes in the minutes have a rather curious item. Quote, I speak confidently. When Porter Rockwell came in with the mail, I met him. The last time he came, he was intoxicated. Close quote. The scribe not only thought it was important to point out that the mail had been delivered during the dedication, but to point out how confident he was about Rockwell's former condition. Apparently, Orrin was sober for the temple dedication, and following the motto of the United States Post Office, he delivered the mail come rain, shine, or temple dedication. The scribe then continues on, reporting the remainder of the temple dedication. I have one last story about Orrin Porter Rockwell and the word of wisdom and prophecy. Agnes Coolbraith married Joseph Smith's brother, Don Carlos. Not long after Don Carlos died in 1841, Joseph Smith married his brother's widow in what appears to be an Old Testament-style levirate marriage, where a brother is supposed to marry his deceased brother's wife or wives to take care of them. Agnes caught typhoid fever in 1855 and lost all of her hair. And as you may recall, some of you may recall earlier, Joseph Smith had uttered a rather famous prophecy to Rockwell. He said, quote, I prophesy in the name of the Lord that you, Orrin Porter Rockwell, so long as you shall remain loyal and true to thy faith, need not fear no enemy. Cut not thy hair, and no bullet or blade can harm thee. Close quote. But Orrin's sympathy for Agnes, who had lost her hair, outweighed his determination to keep the prophecy, and he cut his hair to provide her with a wig. Apparently, referring to the earlier prophecy, he claimed that henceforth, apparently because of his haircut, that he would no longer be able to control his drinking and swearing. Fortunately, Agnes Kulbreth survived, and her daughter, Ina, became the first poet laureate of California.
One scotch, one bourbon.
So now we're going to take a side note for a minute and let historian Joe Geisner talk about some of the things that happened and responses that apostles had in the quorum at the time. Okay, I'm really happy to bring on an old friend of mine, historian and researcher Joe Geisner. Joe, can you say hello?
Hi, Lindsay, and hi, audience. I hope you're doing well this evening.
So, Joe, you and I have known each other a really long time, and you've been one of the most popular guests on the Year of Polygamy podcast. So I'm really excited that you're coming on to talk about the Word of Wisdom today.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about it. I hope that it'll be fun and entertaining for people, along with getting some information.
So before I have you tell us more about the Word of Wisdom, can you tell us a little bit about your background, more of how you got interested in this and sort of what you do?
Well, you know, I think my favorite thing is actually the podcast you and I've done together. I've really enjoyed those. And we've covered fun topics and controversial topics and some pretty heartbreaking topics. So my interest is, I would say, I read everything that I could get my hands on when it came to the New Mormon history. I absolutely love the New Mormon history, and I've been able to write some articles, reviews, been involved in the Leonard Arrington diaries, the publication of those, actually finishing up a book that Signature Books will be publishing next year, 2020, and it is authors who have written their story. Each chapter will be their story of their book and how it came about that they actually wrote their book. Because this all began by me becoming a book collector. And so my first love in many ways is books and book collecting. And I thought, what better way to show that and have authors tell their stories? Just a sneak peek, Linda Newell has written her story and Val Avery's story of doing Mormon Enigma, and it is amazing. This is a story that she's told in bits and pieces, but this is it. This is the story.
Also, another thing that you're involved in is the John Whitmer Historical Association. So why don't you give a plug for that and tell people what that is and how they can learn more about it?
Yes. Thank you, Lindsay, for doing that. John Whitmer Historical Association is a pretty small group compared to Sunstone and Mormon History Association. I'm not even sure the total number of subscribers and members, but are the conferences get anywhere from 200 to 300 people. And we are actually starting our conference in Rochester, New York, and it's going to be focused on the Burned Over District. And that is occurring starting next Thursday. Ann Taves will be speaking Thursday evening, and then Friday and Saturday will be sessions. Next year, in 2020, in September, is the conference in St. George. And we have got some great people already involved with being participants in presenting and tours and all kinds of stuff. So that's an exciting time for people who live in the Intermountain West. I would encourage you to look at that. I don't know, Lindsay, how you feel about, maybe we could even put the link for the conference up with the podcast since we're talking about it.
Okay, why don't we get into why we brought you on today to talk about sort of the modern history of the Word of Wisdom. And I'm sure we'll bring you back on again. You've been a favorite of the Year of Polygamy podcast, and I'm so excited that you're on the Sunstone Mormon History podcast.
Well, thank you, Lindsay. And, you know, you and I agree. You and I have lots of fun doing this. So this is, hopefully this will be fun. I thought it would be fun to begin with a little story about J. Golden Kimball and B.H. Roberts. And I've told you before in our discussions, matter of fact, anybody who's ever heard me talk, that Roberts has to be my favorite general authority of all time. He always, whenever there's been surveys done among Mormon scholars, Roberts always comes out on top, is the top Mormon scholar. Well, this is found in the March 1985 Sunstone. It's also, I think, on the website. It'll be issue number 47 for people who'd like to read it. James N. Kimball would write, I don't think it was every issue, but at least it was quite a few issues. He would write a little blurb about Kimball, J. Golden Kimball, and it was called Golden Nuggets. And I'm going to read just a little bit of one about the Word of Wisdom, in fact. Uncle Golden, this is the beginning of James's little piece. Uncle Golden struggled with the Word of Wisdom, was really not his alone. Another member of the First Council of the 70, Brother B.H. Roberts, had problems with alcohol. Perhaps that was one of the reasons they were such good friends. They often traveled together. Uncle Golden said that when they were back in the hotel room after a long day of preaching and teaching the gospel and meeting with the saints, Brother Roberts would ask Uncle Golden to go get him something so that he might imbibe and relax and sleep better. Uncle Golden was happy to do this, but he mentions in his diary that after several drinks, Brother Roberts became very morose and depressed. He told Uncle Golden how terrible he felt that he had this problem and how hypocritical he was to represent himself to the saints as a leader while struggling with his temptation. Uncle Golden would try to help him through the night. On one occasion, Golden went over and put his arm around him and said, "B.H., I want you to know something. Even when you're drunk, you're a hell of a lot better man than most of the brethren are sober." I've always loved that story. And Roberts, unfortunately, had diabetes and lost both of his feet from diabetes. He also was an amazing man in many, many ways. The other person I'd like to talk about, and a contemporary of B.H. Roberts, is Stephen L. Richards. Stephen L. Richards was an apostle, and during the events that I'm going to talk about, this is when he was an apostle. He ultimately became David O. McKay's first counselor in the First Presidency, and there's a whole controversy about that that people may want to take a look at in Mike Quinn's Mormon Hierarchy, Extensions of Power. And that might be something that people would find interesting. So this talk by Richards was on April 9th, 1932. And the talk is called Bringing Humanity to the Gospel. This talk can be found and can only be found in its complete text in the May and June 1979 issue of Sunstone. One of the things that has always interested me is censorship or ghost editing. And this is one of the examples that I've used in editing. And until Sunstone actually published the talk, I had no idea that this talk existed. It's my favorite general conference talk. It's a great talk. So I want to read a couple of short passages from the talk. I suggest anybody should go and read the entire talk. The talk is about, it focuses on tolerance, and we as a people should be tolerant of those who we see as sinful, is basically the message that Stephen L. Richards gives. So the last half of the talk, Richards gets into a discussion about the Word of Wisdom. And he says, he calls them delicate matters that he would like to discuss. And he wants to be clear that when he says delicate, he means that he doesn't want to be, he knows that he's running the risk of being misunderstood, but he doesn't want to be misunderstood. And he then uses the example of smoking as something that he would like to talk about. And he goes and he talks a little bit about, you know, was smoking something or the use of tobacco something that 25 or 50 years ago, how did members treat people who did that compared to his day of 1932? he brings up how people react and to others who are not living the word of wisdom, such as smoking. And he uses smoking as pretty much his main theme in discussing, though he does get into a little bit other. He says, so men often construe the word of wisdom as a commandment against it and invest the practice of it with the stigma of sin. I think my own preaching against it may be so construed. Am I right? Are all of us right? Have not some of our people failed to distinguish between the offense and the offender? I do not mean to say that I doubt the wisdom of the word of wisdom. I know that it contains God's wishes and direction for the welfare of his children. And I am sure that those who fail to heed the teachings of it will lose blessings of great worth. But I am not sure that we have not estranged many from the church, or at least contributed to their estrangement by attributing to violation of our standards of health, harmful as it may be, a moral turpitude and sinful magnitude out of proportion of the real seriousness of the offense. Maybe I'm wrong. I do not claim that my analysis is correct, but I think it worthy of your attention. He then goes on and he talks about how he knows that young people feel that they've been ostracized, and that there's an intolerant attitude about those who use tobacco. He says, I believe there are some good people in the church to whom the use of tobacco is so repugnant and who are so offended by those who use it that they may actually develop a feeling akin to hatred towards the smoker. And, you know, that's a pretty powerful thing, because I've seen that in my own life. I have to wonder, who did I treat people that way? And so I think Richards really captures something there. He does condemn smoking along with any of the other things with the word of wisdom, such as tobacco. I mean, such as coffee, tea, and alcohol. So he's very clear that he doesn't want people to be doing it. At the same time, he asks if people should be more tolerant of those. He then talks about, he's actually talking to his audience. He's actually of those who are smoking. He wants to be clear to them. He said, the things you do, these things you do if you smoke, but dear young friends, do not think your church will disown you. Your church sympathizes with you and your weakness. It recognizes the courage and resistance you require to withstand the tremendous temptations to which you are subjected. The appeal of brilliant, seductive advertising, the universality of the practice, the ridicule you must endure to stand out almost alone. Your church understands, boys and girls, and it wants to help you. It invites you to come to its Sunday schools, its mutuals, its sacrament, and other meetings, to take part in its activities and share in its spirit. Don't stray away because your fingers are stained and your breath smells. You may still enjoy brotherhood and sisterhood in the church. You have deprived yourselves of some personal blessings, but you may still regain them. And when you do, you will be happy indeed. We all need to repent of some things, and we can help each other. Remember, there is always a welcome for you. It's quite powerful that he wants people to feel at home at church, even when they are breaking the word of wisdom, I guess is the best way of saying it. I would like to say something comparable. Again, this is Richards, to those who have succumbed to the tea and coffee habit and to the older folk. And here he's condemning people who are drinking tea and coffee, because it was quite common for the generation of Richards, along with those older than him, to drink tea and coffee. He says, brethren and sisters, be careful of your example. Remember that some boy or girl is watching you. Your actions may be the turning point in the youth's resistance. Someday in this life and the life to come, he may accost you with words like these. I might have done great things in life. I had high ambitions. My intentions were good, but I watched you. I followed you, and you led me astray. Such rebuke will not be pleasant. I trust it will not come to many. So he is not suggesting that people should go out and smoke, drink coffee, tea. And that's important to understand for what is going to take place in the backstory of this. But it's very important to know that Richards was not supporting those things with his words. I want to finish about the Richards talk. I want to finish with his second to last paragraph. As I told you, I find this talk to be the best general conference talk ever given. And the irony is it's not available except through Sunstone's website now. So here's Richards again. He says, "I have said these things because I fear dictatorial dogmatism, rigidity of procedure, and intolerance even more than I fear cigarettes, cards, and other devices the adversary may use to nullify faith and kill religion. Fanaticism and bigotry have been the deadly enemies of true religion in the long past. They have made it forbidding, shut it up in cold gray walls of monastery and nunnery, out of the sunlight and fragrance of the growing world. They have garbed it in black and then in white, when in truth it is neither black nor white, any more than life is black or white. For religion is life abundant, glowing life, with all its shades, colors, and hues, as the children of men reflect in the patterns of their lives, the radiance of the Holy Spirit in varying degrees." He then asks that people would understand what he has said. So now I think we should talk about the backstory behind why it was censored. Why was this talk never published in conference report? Why you can't find the talk anywhere? And we won't get into all the reasons that I think this talk is and was so disturbing to the general authorities, to the church, and to the church leadership in general, because there are multiple reasons. But we can delve into the word of wisdom part pretty well. So immediately after that session of conference, and by the way, the Salt Lake Tribune, which is quite an interesting thing, because I never saw this in any of the other conference addresses in the Tribune. The Salt Lake Tribune calls this talk the keynote message of the second day of conference. So that's a pretty powerful statement just by the Tribune saying how important this talk was. So immediately after the session, the First Presidency and 12 met to discuss the talk. They were so concerned with Richard's talk that the final decision at the end of May was not to publish it. Talmadge records in his journal what had occurred in that meeting. James Talmadge, he says that he doubted, and the question that arose was whether this address should be published in full at the time with the conference report. Brother, again, quoting Talmadge, "Brother Richards urged a tolerant and kindly attitude towards those of our people, particularly young people who become addicted to some habits in violation of the revelation known as the Word of Wisdom. And a question has been raised as to whether the effect of this address will be that of leading to the thought that the church is lowering its standards." 2 days after Richards gave the talk on April 11th, Heber J. Grant, who was president of the church at the time, recorded in his diary that he had been in contact with mission presidents and stake presidents, and that they were disturbed about Stephen L. Richards' talk. On two different days, April 22nd and May 2nd, Richards wrote a letter to two different friends expressing the hope that his discourse will be helpful to better understandings and that no one will get from it the impression that I desire to lower the high standards to which we have always held. On April 26th, Apostle David O. McKay said in his diary that Joseph Fielding Smith, Richards, and McKay were busy editing Richards' talk. On May 5th, at the First Presidency and 12 meeting, there was a long discussion about Richards' talk and whether it should be published in the conference report. After the meeting, Grant told McKay and Anthony Ivins that Richard had made a mistake when he delivered the address, but today he made a fool of himself. That evening, Grant confided in his diaries that it would be a mistake to publish Richard's address. Shortly thereafter, Grant left Salt Lake City for D.C., where he visited with U.S. Senator and Apostle Reed Smoot. On May 8th, Smoot recorded in his diary that in the evening had a long talk with President Grant about conditions at home. He told me of the unfortunate remarks Stephen L. Richards made at the last conference. Stephen L. was ready to resign, but President Grant thought that would not happen. That's a pretty powerful thing. By this point, almost a month after conference, so 29 days after conference, Richards had basically come to the point where he was willing to resign being an apostle over this talk, because I think Richards felt so strongly about what he had said and that it was the right thing to say that he was unwilling to give to the demands that they were making. So after Grant returned home, Richards then told him on May 26 that he felt he had made a mistake by preaching his address and that it was all right for him and the first presidency to take whatever action they saw fit regarding the talk. So after almost another month, or 3 weeks, Richards clearly had softened on his position. Grant recorded that he was very happy to have Richards make this confession because he had a great deal of worry during the trip east. On May 27th, Grant told one of the staff at the Improvement Era that the magazine could not publish Richards' talk. So besides talks by general authorities at conference going into the conference report, they also would be published in the Improvement Era, much like the Ensign does today. On May 30th, Grant wrote to Smoot about Richards' confession, saying that he had made a mistake in giving the address and that it was all right for the first presidency to publish the talk. Grant believed that it would be very difficult to print the address since it would need a statement accompanying the test, which would then bring more attention to the talk. Grant decided to let the matter drop, and if it doesn't appear in the conference pamphlet, it will soon be forgotten and that the speech was made. How true. That was essentially what happened until Sunstone published it in their May-June 1979 issue. So essentially, the talk was forgotten. Now, the focus seems to have been on the word of wisdom part. And as I said, there were other things that I discovered that the talk had also brought up. Because at the same time, there were ordinances that had been changed in the temple. And so there was a sense that the fundamentalist would take hold of that, this particular talk, which they actually ultimately did, and use this talk as a reason. And the newspaper accounts pretty much cover that. So the lucky thing for me is that I actually found three earlier drafts of the talk. And what I discovered also is that there was actually a ad lib going on during conference. And so there was a great deal in the talk before the, or not a great deal, but there was things in the talk that ultimately was not even published in the Sunstone edition. So that gives you an idea of how, in at least in 1932, how when a general authority would talk about tolerance when it came to the word of wisdom, how the other members of the first presidency in Quorum of the 12 could not allow that talk to be published. And as Grant said, and it will hopefully be forgotten.
I don't want soda, no bubble gum. You got what I want, just...
Once more to ponder about the nature of the word of wisdom in the 1860s and 70s, let me give you two stories you can file under the heading of gross. First, Brigham Young from 1861, quote, "Many of the brethren chew tobacco, and I have advised them to be modest about it. Do not take out a whole plug of tobacco in meeting before the eyes of the congregation, and cut off a long slice and put it in your mouth to the annoyance of everyone around. Do not glory in this disgraceful practice. If you must use tobacco, put a small portion in your mouth where no person sees you, and be careful that no one sees you chew it. I do not charge you with sin. You have the word of wisdom. Read it. Some say, oh, as I do in private, so do I in public, and I am not ashamed of it. It is at least disgraceful. Some men will go into a clean and beautifully furnished parlor with tobacco in their mouths and feel, I ask no odds. I would advise such men to be more modest, and not spit upon the carpets and furniture, but step to the door, and be careful not to let any person see you spit. Or, what is better, omit chewing until you have an opportunity to do so without offending. Yeah, quit spitting on people's carpets, jerks. All right, now my favorite. Brigham Young from the April 1870 General Conference. On Sunday, after meeting, going through the gallery, which had been occupied by those claiming no doubt to be gentlemen, and perhaps brethren, you might have supposed that cattle had been standing around there and dropping their nuisances. Here and there were great quids of tobacco in places a foot or 2 feet square smeared with tobacco juice. I wish the doorkeepers, when in the future they observe any persons besmearing the seats and floor in this way, to request them to leave the house, and if they refuse and will not stop spitting about and besmearing their neighbors, just take them and lead them out carefully and kindly. It is an imposition for those claiming to be gentlemen to spit tobacco juice for ladies to draw their clothes through and besmear them, or to leave their dirt in the house. We request all addicted to this practice to omit it while in this house. Elders of Israel, if you must chew tobacco, omit it while in meeting, and when you leave, you can take a double portion if you wish to. There you have it. The 19th century is both crunk and besmeared.
So, in the midst of all this spitting in the tabernacle, it seems that there was another uptick in trying to emphasize the word of wisdom. How convenient. Interestingly, this was pitched on economic rather than spiritual grounds at the time. Brigham, Mr. Home Economy himself, repeatedly noted how much precious hard currency was going to tobacco, which was taking resources out of Deseret. So the council wasn't, remember to love your temple. It was, quit giving your coppers to Uncle Sam. And another side note, the article that outlined these economic motivations, written by Leonard Arrington, was published in the very first issue of BYU Studies. This idea that financial concerns were what motivated Brigham Young rather than, you know, a revelation, caused Apostle Mark Peterson to metaphorically have a stroke, and BYU Studies was actually suspended for a year. Did I tell you that this was our sacred cow? Once again, this emphasis that Brigham Young was talking about really didn't take the way he wanted, and things stayed in the same sort of laissez-faire situation. One particular area in Mormonism that was unique was southern Utah, aka Utah's Dixie, with its church-appointed vineyards. That's right, there was an actual Dixie wine mission. There is perhaps no better illustration of the paradox than that in 1887, the tithing office in St. George was practically busting its pants open with more than 6,000 gallons of wine that had been contributed as tithing. You know, you can still drive by it in Tokerville. There's the wine house by the Nagel family. They were called to make this great wine. And there's said to be a bottle of it in the cornerstone of the St. George Temple. Yeah, it's in the dissertation of the guy from BYU. So by the turn of the century, this particular paradox had been decided on, and the wine saints were told to dig up the vines. Give me wine, 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 all the time, time, time.
'Cause when I drink it, I feel so doggone fine. Yet another attempt at emphasis came in 1883 during the last hurrah of the School of the Prophets. So after it had gone on for a while during Brigham Young, John Taylor kind of revived it, and this was one of the things they talked about. Wilford Woodruff noted after a discussion, quote, "We have come to the conclusion that we will more fully observe the word of wisdom, as we have all more or less been negligent upon that point." For a time at least, there were some more extensive local efforts to boost the compliance, and they had some temporary results, but by the 1890s, again, not much had changed. Guess what happened? Yep, that's right, more tough talk from the pulpit. Nobody talked tougher than Wilford Woodruff. In the October 1894 General Conference, he thundered, quote, "The word of wisdom applies to Wilford Woodruff, the president of the church, and it applies to all the leaders of Israel, as well as to the members of the church. And if there are any of these leading men who cannot refrain from using tobacco or liquor in violation of the word of wisdom, let them resign and others take their places. There may be things contrary to the word of wisdom that we indulge in and that we think we cannot live without. If we cannot, let us die." Probably thinking two things at this point. First, yikes. Glad blood atonement wasn't part of the discussion. And second, wait, isn't this the same Wilford Woodruff that, not long after the sermon, got cold one morning and, quote, "took a little brandy sling and a cup of coffee"? Yeah, same guy. However, this is where it starts to get fun. 1890 up to about 1930 is such an important period of Mormon history. Word of wisdom, like so many other things, morphs into its current form during this very important period.
During this period, church leaders are really hammering it out. On the one side, we get more rare statements like Lorenzo Snow arguing they should really preach pumping the brakes on eating meat, and George Teasdale similarly stating that eating pork was way worse than tea or coffee. But why are we talking meat now? Why are we talking tea or coffee? Brian, give us some context.
So in the neglected what you can and should do, there's this really interesting phrase about meat that says it shouldn't be used only, you know, should be eaten sparingly, only in time of cold or famine. And that has been really debated. Part of it is there's this great comma in there that snuck in there somehow. And that's, you know, it's like the magic bullet with Kennedy, this missing comma that suddenly appears. So the deal is where does meat fit in? Is it something that we should do, that we shouldn't do? Mormons, known for not drinking tea and coffee, are known, however, for loving their meat. So this the question is then the level of importance. How does it stack up to the no's of no coffee, no tea, no alcohol? Clearly, people like Lorenzo Snow and Teasdale are arguing that this part of the Word of Wisdom is actually more important than the no's, which from our modern point of view is so interesting. However, I imagine if you go far enough into Reddit, you can probably find a sub where you've got some anti-meat Mormons talking this up.
Okay, so back to Teasdale and Lorenzo Snow. They sort of start to have a focused discussion on this topic, why eating pork was way worse than eating coffee or tea. And they really want to come to a consensus. In 1898, they had a pretty wide-ranging chat, and it's really fascinating. 60-plus years in, and John Henry Smith is still asking, well, what are hot drinks? Woodruff then said, quote, he regarded the Word of Wisdom in its entirety as given of the Lord for the Latter-day Saints to observe, but he did not think that bishops should withhold recommends from persons who did not adhere strictly to it, end quote. So basically the status quo, sort of the thing that Joe Geisner was talking about. So 2 years later, another great discussion in the quorum, John Henry Smith flat out says that the Word of Wisdom allowed for beer. Have you noticed the impact specific personalities are having yet? We got another Smith advocating that beer's okay. Brigham Young Jr. backs him up saying, quote, for me, Danish beer is a blessing, end quote. Don't we all know it? Just kidding. I don't even know what that is. Still don't know how to make a cup of coffee, and I'm an adult grown woman. Two changes after that mark the beginning of the modern look of the Word of Wisdom. First, in 1906, the First Presidency and the 12 quit using wine for the sacrament in their meetings. 1906, so you got to understand that the general authorities were drinking wine in their sacraments up until 1906 when they sort of officially change it. Then, of a more lasting impact, the nationwide prohibition movement starts to gain steam. So now all of a sudden we're letting the world's ideas creep in, mingle with our scripture. Opinions on what to do with prohibition were mixed. So Heber J. Grant actually had zero doubts about what to do. Bring in old Heber J.
One point before I tangent myself with Heber, this idea of the mild drinks, so the, you know, beer versus whiskey. The Word of Wisdom does specifically say that mild drinks of barley are okay. And anyone who's made beer is thinking, okay, that's beer you're talking about there. And guys like John Henry Smith clearly are like, yeah, exactly. Beer is okay. It says so right there in the Word of Wisdom. Again, modern Mormons look at that and you're like, you have an apostle advocating for beer. This is a different world. So, okay, tangent time. Heber J. Grant is really a difficult person to understand. So, if a little bit of his history. So, he's left without his father at the age of 9 days when Jedediah Grant dies, taking the steam of the Reformation with him.
I just want to point out, given everything I know about Jedediah Grant, who was known as Brigham Young's sledgehammer, can't wait to talk about him when we get in the frontier period. I think Heber J. Grant probably did well to not be raised by such a zealot.
He probably would have blood atoned him at some point for, you know, leaving his toys on the stairs or something. Jedediah Grant was crazy. Trust us. When we get to him, you'll hear some fun things. So, all right. So Jedi dies at 9 days. His mother, Rachel Ivins, never remarries and had a very difficult time trying to provide for them. She was a very faithful, very proud woman, and she made it happen. So then as Heber enters adulthood, he wanted to make sure Rachel was taken care of, and there's this great story of him trying to get life insurance. As Grant later told it, he was too skinny to get coverage. That's a pre-existing condition you don't think about very often. So he goes to a doctor, and the doctor's like, what you need, son, is some beer. Pretty soon, Heber has insurance coverage and a drinking problem.
No, like he legit had a drinking problem. I think he called it an addiction to beer.
He was very candid about it later, too. He said, you know, it was 3 glasses of beer, and then 3 became 4 and 5 and 6. And then, you know, he was Mr. Self-Discipline, so he made himself quit. And then he develops a new addiction to the Word of Wisdom. Toward the end of Joseph F. Smith's administration, so ending in 1918, they're starting to get tough on Word of Wisdom, and they do it in an interesting way by tying it to temple admission. However, they still are kind of grandfathering people in, literally. Old people are, you know, he talks about how take it easy on the old guys with their, you know, talk to them, but if they can't, they're probably okay. However, by the time Grant comes around, it starts to become hard and fast, and it's at that point that our modern understanding of the Word of Wisdom really sets in.
And just look back to all the things that Joe Geisner talked about, too. So it's at this point that Brian talked about, it's sort of left for Mormon culture to really nail that coffin shut. So we have an Improvement Era article that explored the topic on, should LDS drink Coca-Cola question? And they decided no. And I was one of those Mormons that followed that until, interestingly enough, it was on my honeymoon. And we were 2 kids locked up in a hotel with no car. We ordered pizza and they brought us a 2-liter bottle of Coke. What do we do?
Man, don't you love how Mormons, when they go crazy, they really get crazy. We're on our honeymoon, baby. Let's go get some Diet Cokes.
I gotta say, it was the most wicked thing, too. But we're like, we're married now. Anything goes. Okay. Focus. So, oddly enough, the non-Mormon state health director tried to get Heber J. Grant on board with his efforts to prevent anyone from drinking Coke. The dude was peddling bad stats, like Coke had 5 times more caffeine than coffee, which is opposite in actuality of the truth. It's the same thing every time I post a Diet Coke thing, and some of you listening are probably guilty of this. You'll post an article about how I'm going to die of brain cancer, and I will tell you what I tell everyone else. You can say I died doing what I love. So once Grant figures out that these stats are kind of wonky, he states that he wasn't on board with this total anti-Coke lobby, but the next 100 years of Mormons wouldn't know it because we mentioned the Widstow's work earlier. Books like theirs and articles in the Improvement Era slowly solidified the cultural consensus until Word of Wisdom was synonymous with Mormon. And Diet Coke and Coca-Cola became another cultural signaling. I always knew that it was for the bad Mormons. The ones that were a little less righteous than myself. Now, Mormons, remember this. If you think the Word of Wisdom sucks, it could have been worse in the hands of some of Joseph Smith's contemporaries, like Mr. Sylvester Graham, who reached his apex just after the Word of Wisdom. And let's just say Graham was an absolute crusader for wacky ideas. He ardently denounced masturbation and honestly pretty much all sex. And his solution for fighting down those urges was through diet. So no spices and bland food all around, including his famous cracker, so named. So the next time you have s'mores around the fire, remember that a graham cracker a day keeps your little factory okay. In the name of cheese and rice, amen.
All right, I know you're all hyped for Books of Mormon tonight, but it's the Theses of Mormon Report. And I would encourage you to say the word theses as much as you can, because 95% of the time you do, the other person thinks you're saying something different. It's a lot of fun. So with how integral the Word of Wisdom is to the LDS identity, you'd think there'd be like 5 or 6 really solid books on the history of it. Not so. There's some good articles that talk about different parts of it, but Paul Peterson's master's thesis, An Historical Analysis of the Word of Wisdom, is really still the best resource. It's going on 50 years old, so it's got some signs of age, but overall, it's still very helpful.
Special thanks to Claire Barris for his amazing timeline, which we pulled a lot of this, and his contributions to this topic. As always, Christopher C. Smith and Joe Geisner. Stuck in the jug, a slice of onion and a raw one. Draw one. Waiter, waiter, percolator. I love coffee. I love tea. I love the jabber jive and it loves me. Coffee and tea and the jabber and me. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup. Oh, Boston beans, soy beans. Yeah.
I'm not Jean of Bonafide.
You look pretty righteous, so I'm not sure you're going to understand this simile. But most podcasts are like beer. You have to drink a lot to get that buzz. The Sunstone Magazine podcast, on the other hand, is like whiskey. Small glass, big buzz. That's because our podcast isn't about interviews, conversation, or witty banter. Rather, it presents audible quality recordings of Sunstone's best articles, essays, fiction, and poetry. Do you want to hear what the best LDS minds have to say when they say it perfectly? Then this podcast is for you. Listen to some of our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone, and then join us for a weekly shot of the best of Mormon thought and experience. And yes, you'll be able to drive home safely afterward and get a temple recommend if you want.